C1 PR. Number 24A.
We take the Saturday afternoon just to go over what we have been discussing last Sunday and just to discuss one or the other point here, perhaps to help to elucidate what we were trying to see last time and perhaps to help you to see clearer what you have been pondering during the last 8 weeks. And if we do that, I still want to stress that above everything, it must be science what we are considering, and that which we are considering must be considered in a scientific way and not merely in a religious way. You know how Mrs. Eddy uses the term science in her textbook about 1,000 times, and the term religion she uses only about 40 times in the textbook. And in those 40 references, there are perhaps only 3 or 4 positive references hinting to the fact that what she has discovered is religion. Just as this science has to do with government, with relationship, with true economy, with true politics, well, with every phase of the human life. And so it also has to do with religion. But the main tone, the overall tone of her discovery is science. You may say, well, we know that now. We have heard that so often. Well, that may be true. But that is not the main point if we have heard it so often. The main point is, do we really study our textbook scientifically or not? The main point really is, do I feel my way in a scientific way? Do I have in me the urge of finding out reality in a scientific way or merely in a religious way? That's the point. And so let's be very clear about this, that we renew in us the affection for science day in and day out. I think there is not many days that pass in my life where I don't renew, in one way or the other, my love for the discovery of Christian Science as science. Just to marvel at the promise that lies embedded in the mere fact that what we find in the textbook is a science. And to me it seems that one of the most subtle way of animal magnetism is to urge us or influence us to investigate Christian Science in a non-scientific way, be it in a religious way, be it in an emotional way, be it in a way of blind faith or whatever it is, but it's animal magnetism of the most subtle form which tries to come in and make us feel that we can get at being, at holiness, on another way than on a scientific ordered way. Now, the discovery of Mrs. Eddy is science, and science means a science reduced to a system which embodies laws and order. And therefore, I try to stress perhaps a bit much, but intentionally, the order of what we are considering in each chapter. Because I feel that little by little, we get into the rhythm of order, of a developing sequence which is purest order of the law of accomplishment or of creation. And that little by little we get into that rhythm and it stays with us and we embody order. If we try to sidestep science and order, well, we serve animal magnetism. Just recently I came across one of the many passages where Mr. Dawley was speaking about this point. He said in the verbatim report 25, page 32, he said, "I don't know any greater sin than approaching God in a chaotic, disordered, emotional, vague way. To me, that's the sin of sins. To approach God through the Word of God, the Christ, Christianity and science, is the holiness of being. And that is your privilege." That's how far the quotation goes. And you see how he says that to him, it is the sin of sins to approach divinity in another way than in a scientific way. So often we think of sin in a merely moral or human way, instead of being aware that the much bigger sin, that sin which shuts us out from holiness, is the belief that we can approach God in another than an ordered scientific way. So, let's be clear that science must be our guiding star, and all what science implies must be our privilege to follow. Naturally, science demands of us honest investigation. It demands of us a very honest investigation of the science of being. Here it is an honest investigation of the textbook. And honest investigation means quite a lot. It means that we approach the text in an unprejudiced way. That we don't approach the textbook with preconceived view of Christian science, but that we approach every time the textbook with a completely clear, unprejudiced mind, which always approaches the textbook with that sense, "Oh, I would like to know what is the depth and breadth and height and might and glory of this book, of the message of this book." Then I approach it with an unpreconceived mind. And then we are not in danger of trying to graft a scientific view on a religious or emotional approach. This is a big danger. It's a big danger which I always see in me and in others, that we have some concept, preconceived concept of what science is, of what the world is and the system is, and then with that preconceived mind we go to the textbook and study it. And so we try to graft something holy on something which is not pure or which is not entirely pure. Science, therefore, has very great demands on mortals. It has great demands on mortals because mortals are very unwilling to let go preconceived concepts of deity, of God, of man. And that's one of the big claims, especially if one has been for years and years and years, perhaps in the movement, that one has some difficulty to be always fresh and new, face to face to God every day. Always an open page, always a clean page on which God can write his message. That's the poor in spirit, and to them is the kingdom of God. So let's be humble about the approach to God, and let's be fresh in our love to approach God every day. The moment we have inward in us the feeling that we say, well, I have studied that now so often and so long and so much and so on, we are self-satisfied. We already feel, well, I know already quite a lot. I'm no more a beginner. And we are proud of what we already know. And that's not the poor in spirit. Prayer tells us that we always approach God with a desire to know God as he is, and to let mind mold our thoughts that they may take form in words and in deeds. Every day it's that newness of love towards seeking God as he is. And that's the ground on which a seed of divinity can grow and blossom. Then, let me perhaps stress another point which I may see from time to time with the students, and that is that for one or the other student, it seems cold and hard to approach God as a science. But the matter of the fact is that it is just the opposite, that it is the loveliest, tenderest, warmest thing we can think of. Because if science shows us the way to God and the ordered way to God, that way which wants us to which tries to prevent us to go a zigzag way, that science shows us the direct line to God, well then science must be one of the most loveliest, tenderest thing on earth. It is love, really, that is always guiding us through science. That's why love, the synonymous term love, is so often coupled with the term divine science. Because love has a perfect goal to attain. It has a perfect plan how to work out things. It has a full promise for each one of us. And I can't think out something lovelier than to know the way to that, than to go the way to that promise, to that fulfillment. So let's see that there is love behind the fact of Mrs. Eddy's discovery, namely love that has ushered into being divine science. It isn't something cold and hard. It is something tender. Now, last time we were considering the sixth and the seventh subject of prayer and the Lord's Prayer. And so I want to go over our notes and make a few remarks on what you have been studying. We come to the prayer, the sixth prayer, the prayer of truth. You know, so often we say quite right, ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. And in this sixth subject, for the first time, Mrs. Eddy gives some hints on healing, of how truth makes free. Now, ye shall know the truth. Well, what does it mean? What shall you know? What shall you know truth? Is truth just a word, or what is it? And so we find here in this whole structure of the first chapter that truth builds on the five preceding subjects. That to know the truth means that we know mind, the first subject, second subject, the third subject, fourth subject, the fifth subject, and know that consciously. Then we come to the sixth subject. That when these five preceding subjects become conscious in consciousness, when we affirm them consciously and lovingly in our consciousness, that then that consciousness is that consciousness which depicts the sixth prayer, that prayer which knows no other consciousness, that consciousness which is free from mortal consciousness, and therefore free from all what mortal consciousness has produced. So, in order to feel the touch of the sixth subject rightly and properly and understandingly, let's quickly go through the first five subjects just to build up in our consciousness what prayer is. In the first subject, you remember, it was that state of consciousness which said, open your thought unprejudicedly, that's not the word I think, to mind, to the allness and isness and unchangeability of the All God. Open your mind to the All. Therefore, stop pleading, begging, asking, calling on God. It's an opening of thought to be called the allness and isness of divinity. And to accept in thought, as that first subject has shown us, to accept in thought what? It says, accept in thought in your desire that mind knows all, that spirit can't help but bless, that soul can't help but be unchangeable, that principle is a science of harmony. Open your thought to the isness of being which is already now and here pouring forth million times more than what we accept right now for each one of us. Open your thought, she pointed out there, to God as truth, that consciousness of God which is right now, here and now, on the whole universe working right, and which needs no advice from us how to manage the universe. Open your thought, he said there, that to love, that God's work is done. Is done. And that his rule is established. And that God is perfect here and now. That's one of the most wonderful prayers, the prayer of the open thought, to be willing to let every limited sense of divinity go, to abandon every limitation in thought, and to broaden out thought to that wideness and vastness as God really is. And then she comes to the second subject, to the second prayer, to the second prayerful attitude. And she says, well, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that big? Isn't that big enough? Do you want more than that? Why are we not grateful for that vision? Why don't we love that big promise of that vision? Why are we not grateful for that bigness? Why doesn't our heart and patience and meekness and obedience go out and worship that vision? And we have that tender sense of the second prayer, where inwardly in us something prays in gratitude for God as he is. Where inwardly in us there is no material, human, selfish desire. Where there is no desire for material gain and material means and aims. Where there is just that deep, devotional gratitude for being as being is. It doesn't ask for anything. It just gives anything to the divine being. Then she comes to the third subject and says there, well, if we begin to worship God as he is, and to worship God as he is through expressing the divine qualities, and then in the third prayer she says, well, but this means that you keep that pure, and therefore that you rebuke every attempt and every temptation which is against that order, which wants to sidestep that order, which says in oneself, well, there is another way to God than this way. And it says, just rebuke that human sin which does not want to accept the divine order, the scientific order. And so this involves naturally the willingness to reform inwardly. It involves the willingness that we rely, so to say, on that sober resolution to go the way of the first and second subject. Not to let us influence by emotionalism and ecstasy, but to culture that spiritual sense and not let ourselves be sidetracked in any way. See, you get some touch of firmness already here, where the third prayer says it's the prayer of sinlessness, where we just feel, let no other attempt come into my prayer than that what Mrs. Eddy has presented as the first and second prayer. Well, that leads us to where? The more we rebuke sin, the more we rebuke to speculate on another solution, the more we cling to the divine order and therefore clings to the spiritual sense of prayer, the more something in us is changing and changing, and we are reformed. But what is going to be reformed? And here the fourth prayer comes in. And the fourth prayer comes in and says, but this reaches every department of life. This is not just a religion, where in a religious way you have to conform to a dogma or doctrine. But this is life. This is your whole, prayer is your whole life, or your whole life and being is a brick prayer, is one continual prayer. Therefore, every phase of your being, every department of our life should or is then slowly and slowly conforming to this prayer of mind and spirit and soul. So that everything, every phase of our being, be it words and deeds and feeling and actions and motives, inward and outward expressions, that all that has one touch always, is always lined up to the first and second prayer, which conforms us as an entirely principled being. See, that's the prayer which frees us from hypocrisy. It's the prayer which frees us from that sense which says in us, well, I should be so and so, and I should act so and so. It's the moral command. But that is not prayer. Feeling I should act like this and like that, and I should be so good and so good, that's a moral command. What Mrs. Eddy presents is something much more profound, much deeper, and much holier. She presents that if I line up my thoughts to the first prayer, and my thoughts are just going out to the oneness and bigness and allness of divinity, which is pouring forth everything and acting right and doing right. And if in the second prayer, with every phase of my being, I love that, and I worship that, and value that, and then in the third, that with every phase of my being, I resist the temptation to let this vision go and this love go, then naturally everything in me voices, so to say, voices the divine order, the divine nature. And then I don't have to be good. And then I don't have to act good. Then I am good, then I act good. I'm principled. And so you can see how the force, how if we follow the tenderness but the, and yet strictness of divine evolution, of the divine evolution of manhood, if we follow that, we just can't help becoming a principled being instead of a person. We just can't help it. It's a natural evolution.